So welcome to the second podcast in the Overthrow podcast series. There are six podcasts about how a challenger mindset can help brands accelerate into this new era. And I'm joined today by two guests, actually. One is Kerry Childers, who is the Group Brands Director of Direct Line Group. Hello, Kerry.
Hello.
And I'm joined by Hugh Cameron, who is the Chair of PhD UK.
Hello.
So good. So tell me about your positive surprise from this. It can be a professional surprise, it can be a brand or a category that you've noticed doing particularly well, or something that's happened in terms of culture around you, your neighborhood, or in your country or in the world. Kerry, what's been your positive surprise coming out of this?
One of my surprises actually through this is really the adaptability and the resilience of us humans and the British in particular. I saw a great piece of insight from Google probably about 4 weeks into lockdown, where they were going through the real sort of key search trends for the first 3 weeks. First 3 weeks, unsurprisingly, was, you know, high on searches on COVID symptoms, comparing populations of the UK versus Italy, as people were really trying to get their heads around just how bad this was. By week three, the peaks were for fake tan, gel nails, and hair dye, which just sort of was a real insight into the human psyche of, right, let's move on and get back to the important things in life.
That's absolutely fantastic. I saw a wonderful thing building on that of a Chinese site that had done makeup tutorials around eyeshadow and eye makeup that you could wear over above your mask. And they'd set up these tutorials and sales had popped 150% in 3 days, I think. And they picked up 8.3 million users in 24 hours. So yeah, I love that. We just revert to how we always were. Hugh, what about you? What's your surprise?
So my surprise is from watching a wonderful TV show on Channel 4 called Grayson Perry's Art Club. And he's really captured a reality of us all living in this kind of pause world, of how when we stop and we look around, actually we're encouraged to experiment more. And all the people who sent their art into Grayson Perry have really captured these wonderful kind of experimental statements of boldness in their surroundings. And it's really uplifting to see that. And it's made me think that, you know, we are very resourceful people. And oddly enough, constant motion sometimes stops us from trying out the new.
That's lovely. It's lovely. Well, both of yours are so much more kind of profound and insightful than mine. So I apologize for the triviality of this one in that context, but it just was in my kind of Twitter feed today and found it extraordinary. So mine is that Zoom, if you look at market capitalization, is now worth more than the top seven airlines combined. And just obviously, we all knew Zoom was doing well and we all knew the airlines were doing less well, but it's just very striking, the comparative values of those two sets, I think, just in the last couple of months. Anyway, let's get into the meat of it. So thank you both for coming on. Kerry, the last podcast was about kind of how the way that sort of challengers and kind of companies are approaching communications is changing in the downturn. And your experience is so rich and so interesting for us because it's about how a company that had been once a challenger lost its challenger way a little bit, represented itself to a new and changed world. And you needed to land a kind of a new positioning that had some substance to it, but you were also kind of impatient and you didn't want to wait too long to arrive at that. So could you just start us off by talking a little bit about Direct Line, what the situation was when you kind of were there and took over, and a little bit about what happened, and then let's get into the conversation about how much substance you felt you needed and how much you actually had at launch.
So Direct Line, insurance brand business, founded back in 1985, one of the original challengers in the sector, founding direct insurance as we know it. Before that, you had to go down to your local broker's office and get somebody else to do it for you because you weren't competent enough to do it yourself. And so that really drove one of the first sort of revolutions in insurance. And Direct Line was definitely a challenger back in those days. Fast forward on some 30 years later, and it looked quite different with the advent of price comparison websites in the 2000s. Insurance really had become a commoditized category. The whole focus of the conversation had really become about getting the cheapest possible deal. consumers couldn't pull us apart, to the point that people were choosing who to buy from on the basis of a cuddly toy. Mm. Hats off to Compare the Market for that one. And as a direct brand, you know, we'd really lost our mojo from that real direct market pioneer to cash cow. And in a business which kind of also believed itself that price was the kind of only important marker of success and choice for customers, so we weren't in a great space, and to be quite frank, it wasn't really working either. In the space of 4 years, we'd gone from being the most searched brand on Google in our category to being less than the four price comparison websites combined. And yep. We knew that we had to play a really different game. To win in that context.
So what was the strategy and what was the kind of brand idea that you relaunched behind?
So relaunch was the big part of the game. And we knew we had to make a really visible statement about Direct Line to really challenge ourselves and to challenge the category. And we did that back in September 2014 with the launch of a new advertising campaign featuring Harvey Keitel reprising his role as Mr. Wolf from Pulp Fiction, the ultimate fixer. When you've got a back in the movie, when you've got a problem, you call Mr. Wolf because he comes in, sorts it out, minimum fuss and hassle, and gets you where you need to be. And that was really what the heart of what we wanted to be about with consumers was, you know, really when, you know, the shit hits the fan and you're not in a great space as a consumer and you really need your insurer to help you. What you don't want is an insurer that puts your arm around you and tells you it's going to be okay. What you want is an insurer who will come in, know what needs to happen and get it done fast, minimum of fuss and hassle. Yeah. And Harvey as Mr. Wolf really embodied that. So we launched the campaign back in September 2014, and really that was the catalyst, both internally and externally, to drive reappraisal of the brand and get us into a challenger position.
And what was the kind of substantive kind of offer that you were making or remaking to the customer that was so compelling here?
We had done a huge amount of insight work leading up to this, you know, in the face of commoditization and scratching our heads and thinking this just can't be true. So we'd done an awful lot of insight work probably the year preceding, good old fashioned customer research, lots of it, attitudes, behaviour, segmentation, listen to our colleagues in the business as well. And really uncovering that, contrary to popular belief at the time, which was it's all about price and everybody only cares about price, it actually wasn't all about price for many people. And for many people, they recognise that things go wrong in life and they want to put plans in place to protect that. And for them, what they really want from an insurer is somebody will help put them back to where they were before, fast. And that was really the sort of core insight that we held on to, is that people just wanted insurance that worked. Yeah. And worked with that sort of minimum of fuss and hassle. And that was really the sort of insight that the campaign was born out of. But to do that, we also had to have substance. You know, this was not about an advertising campaign with sort of empty promises. You know, Mr. Wolf is all about action, and we had to make sure that we had really good, compelling customer propositions that absolutely demonstrated to customers what we meant by fixing, and customer propositions that they could have a degree of control over or transparency over. Insurance wasn't in the UK, was in a sector where it's all about price, and actually it's all about price because, to be honest, when it comes to it, I think you're going to let me down anyway. I might get my money back, but my goodness, you're going to be a hassle to deal with.
Yeah.
I'm going to have, you very rarely hear anybody saying, oh God, my car's off the road, don't worry, I'll phone the insurance company and they'll sort it out. Much more likely to be a groan and, oh God, here we go, I've got to phone the insurance company, you know, expecting it to be some sort of long and protracted process. Which was really like pulling teeth. And, you know, we had to have propositions that demonstrated that absolutely wasn't the case. So when we launched, not only did we launch an advertising campaign, actually there was a lot of proposition change and customer service change we put into the business at the same time, both so that we could evidence it from a customer point of view, but also to start to build belief internally.
That brilliant. That's so fascinating. Hugh, I know you had a question for Kerry about kind of...
Yeah. Well, I was just interested because, I mean, obviously in insurance, as I understand it, your whole business is risk and you're constantly evaluating the risk you take on individuals, customers, and whole industries. And I just wonder whether you found internally the same risk criteria are put as a lens across marketing and any decisions you wanted to push through the organization.
I think there's probably two aspects to that. So one of them is we're a hugely analytical business. And yes, absolutely. Actually, that's driven quite a lot of our marketing success, is really understanding how our marketing works, and how to really optimize all of our marketing effort, be that investment decisions, content and strategy decisions as well. So I think actually there it's counted in our favor. I think the other aspect is the sort of risk psyche of risk aversion and managing risk. And we're a business which manages risk. You know, not only because of the sector we're in, but a regulated environment. And I think actually the cultural part of that, we were part of RBS for a long time, and in the days where its culture was very much don't put a foot out of line. And so again, that sort of bred a sort of real risk aversion in the business. We are breaking free of that, and the business culture feels quite different today than it did even back then in sort of 2013, which is great. But I think part of the question is, what does it feel like in the face of that? God, you've got to be resilient, you've got to be determined. And the other part is, but you have to find some allies. And I remember right at the outset of before we'd even stumbled across the Fixer campaign with Saatchi & Saatchi, you know, right back at the outset of, right, we think we've got an idea and we know what we want to do. I went round and found a few like-minded people, not in marketing, in other parts of the business, who I knew were believed in the potential in Dartline, I think is probably the first part of it. And knew that to unleash that potential, we were going to have to be prepared to do something different and do something bolder and more decisive than we had been in the past. And having those allies that were in operations, that were in our sort of P&L management teams, that were in our in internal communications teams and our HR teams really helped, actually. Not only did they have a different group of allies themselves inside the business to help spread the word, but it also helped me and my team make sure that what we were putting together was pretty well rounded, and that we weren't blinkered in our determination. And I think, and also, you know, through the dark days, that team keeps you going.
And how the CEO here for you, Kerry, ally, cautious sponsor? How would you describe that relationship?
I remember there was a sort of defining meeting that I'd had with Paul Geddes, who was our CEO at the time. When we'd stumbled across the answer, and we were struggling to cut through, if I'm quite honest. Mm. And we had a meeting where we laid out, this is why we need to do it, and presented what we call a sort of burning platform. This is why we have to act. you know, here are all the warning signs that what we're doing right now is just not working, and we need to deploy a different strategy. And I think coming out of that meeting, we all knew that there was, you know, continuing as we were just really wasn't a viable option. And that gave us the mandate from Paul, like, right, go and fix it. That was critical.
Yeah.
That was critical when we talk about things like our 7-day proposition that we launched with, because we were asking people to move mountains, and there were lots of reasons not to do it, and there were lots of reasons why it shouldn't be a priority. But Paul absolutely made rumour has it he built it into the end of year objective for our Steve Maddox, who runs all of our claims businesses, to make this happen.
Fantastic.
And I think having that mandate and having that support from Paul really mattered. It wasn't easy, though. There were plenty of times where we had to reassure him that we were on the right path, that where we were taking bolder and braver moves, that, you know, we had done all the customer testing and all the consumer testing came back and said, you know, keep going, thumbs up. Because there were plenty of things for even Paul and our chief exec, which, really, have you not gone a bit far this time? And I think reassuring every day along that way with data, insight, whatever it happens to be, that sort of validates that we are moving in the right direction was really, really important too.
Should you, as a kind of a challenger representing itself, should you get the internal culture right first before you launch, or do you in a sense use that external stake in the ground to kind of galvanize the rest of the organization to catch up a little bit?
doing together the external and the internal together at the same time was really important, actually. We knew the spark was there, and for us, we just knew we had to get up and ignite it. But we needed the external work to really help us do that internally and to build belief.
Yeah.
And that was a really important part of the Fixer campaign and the relaunch. Was I remember taking it and showing it internally to teams inside the business, and there was a sort of towards the end a bit of a, but can we really do that? You know, that's and so for us, kind of the external launch was as important internally, if not more, than it was actually externally. Yeah. So we did two things together. You know, the repositioning happened at the same time, where internally we were absolutely selling to our people that we are the fixers, we fix things, that is our job, and we want to turn our internal people into the heroes that do that for customers day in, day out. I think if we'd spent too long upfront addressing internal culture without that, it would have really struggled to stick. It would have really struggled to have sort of belief behind it and build momentum.
Yeah.
And I think that if that there had been a benchmark for that before we were, you know, able to launch, I don't know if we'd ever have got there.
Tell us a little bit about the results. So what's actually happened to the business? Because I know you're onto your new campaign quite recently, but tell us about what's happened since you launched that first campaign.
Hugely successful. And actually, I think, if we're honest, more successful more quickly than we'd anticipated.
Right.
So within a year of launch, we'd reverse sort of a good number of years of decline, and we're back into customer number growth quarter on quarter, which is fantastic.
Mm.
We have significantly reduced the cost per acquisition of our advertising activity, improved ROI significantly over the period of time as well. Got back to market leader position. So it has on many fronts. Our customer NPS scores continue to exceed expectations month on month, and jumped significantly in the first year of launch, not just due to the advertising campaign. You know, as we put in a whole, the organisation put a whole sea of changes in to really live up to the promise that we'd set customers, from removing admin fees, including guaranteed hire cars standard, putting all our frontline people through Connect training so that they could better connect with our customers on the end of the phone. There's a whole swathe of things that we did to really set ourselves apart, and the combination of those sort of, as I said, we keep thinking surely not, but another month of record my customer scores. So it has been a phenomenal success, and continues to be that. And yes, we relaunched our advertising campaign earlier on this year. No way, because the fixer was done and had stopped performing for us, but just recognising that the job was never done.
Yep.
And that we needed to move on and tackle the next challenge.
So listen, you know, final question for the podcast. I really hope both of you will stay in your jobs for a very long time indeed. But should you choose to move on to a new challenger role, what's the one piece of learning of all the many that you could choose from? What's the one thing you would take into your new challenger role?
I think for me, it is, as a leader, you really have to role model it. To unlock those leaps that you really want your business and your people to take. Mm. And so for me, that is being prepared to take them yourself.
Yeah.
And doing that kind of really visibly, and sharing what that's like. You know, it's not easy. So I think you have to share some of that. But I think is first and foremost is you've got to be prepared to take the big leap yourself. To build confidence and belief and to set the bar for people that's really what you want them to do and what you expect to do.
Brilliant, brilliant. Hugh, can I bring you in here? So tell us a little bit about your own journey, sort of PhD, as kind of very much somebody with sort of a challenger DNA. What's the one bit of learning you would take with you?
It's a very small but very significant thing. On everyone who works at PhD's 360-degree annual appraisal, there are three words: live more challenger. How have you demonstrated that you've lived more challenger this year? And that's the thing that enables the 350 or so people that work at PhD in the UK to relentlessly and restlessly drive forwards those ambitions.
Fabulous. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thank you both very much indeed. It was a great pleasure talking to you. On the next podcast, we're going to talk about the changing investment landscape. We're going to talk to a couple of VCs and how their relationship with investing in challengers is changing.